This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. Today I'm talking to Ellen Cassidy. She's the author of a memoir called We Are Here, Memories of the Lithuanian Holocaust. Hi, Ellen. How are you?
Good.
Well, thanks for coming on to talk about your book. I did find it by accident, and I was really interested in your story because, you know, my background is at least in part like yours, half Lithuanian Jewish, and I kind of have a running interest in the stories of Jewish people who lived in Lithuania prior to World War II, which is kind of the demarcation line for a radical change in the way Jews in Europe exist. But maybe you could talk a little bit about how you got interested in Lithuania. I mean, I think at the beginning you were your interest was in learning Yiddish, which I think is an admirable thing to do. And maybe you can talk a little bit about just what got you started.
Well, when my mother was alive, I could count on her to keep hold of the past, the Jewish past. My mother's side of the family was Jewish. My father's side was English, German, and Irish, which is where the name Cassidy comes from, in case you were wondering. But when my mother died, my ancestors in the old Jewish heartland of Lithuania seemed to be slipping away from me. And my mother used to speak a little bit of Yiddish, just sort of sprinkling Yiddish words here and there into her conversation like a spice. But I never learned to speak Yiddish. We didn't speak it at home. And Yiddish being the everyday language of European Jews that was spoken all over Europe up until World War II, when I found out that there was a summer course in Yiddish in Vilnius, the capital of Lithuania, I was eager to go there because I wanted to connect myself to my past. I wanted to breathe the wonderful summer air of the Baltic sky. I wanted to see the places where my great-grandparents had lived and where my grandfather had lived until he was a young man. He came to this country at the turn of the century, turn of the 20th century, escaping the Tsarist draft. But what happened, what ended up happening was that although this was supposed to be a trip into the past and it was very rich in that way, it also turned out to be a contact with the future as well and really a life-changing journey in which I explored Lithuania past and present and got a taste of what the hopefully might be the future for a Lithuania that does embrace its Jewish past, if all things go well. The first thing that happened when I was on the brink of my trip was that I went to visit my Uncle Will, and he was a survivor of the Holocaust in Lithuania. I'd known him all my life. He was now in his late 80s, and I brought some maps that I had downloaded from the internet and asked him exactly where I should go when I went to Lithuania to enroll in this Yiddish course. And he told me about my ancestral town of Rokiškis, which is in the northeast corner of Lithuania. And he told me about the city of Šiaulė or Šiaulė, where he'd been imprisoned in the ghetto. But then he took me aside and revealed a secret about what he had done personally during the Holocaust years. And that secret really shocked me and changed forever my journey to Lithuania, set it on a whole new track that ended up being actually very rewarding.
Yeah, I don't know whether we should give away what that secret is, because I know you didn't tell it at the very beginning of the book. You saved it for later. So it maybe you want to retain the surprise for people who are reading the book rather than tell them now. But it's up to you. I mean, we could talk. One of the things I wanted to ask you about your Uncle Will, now, was he really your great uncle?
Yes, he was my grandfather's brother, who actually a half-brother who'd been born much later after my grandfather left Europe. My Uncle Will was born in the 1920s. And so he was a young man when the Holocaust began, and he was among the thousands of people in the city of Šiaulė who were herded into a ghetto and who had to make life and death, good and evil decisions every day about their own behavior, balancing their intense desire to stay alive with their code of ethics. And this was at the heart of the behavior that he told me about. Something that that became a theme of my book was that also before I went on my trip, I heard from someone in my ancestral town in Lithuania, the town of Rokiškis, that there was an old man in town, a Gentile man, who wanted to talk to me. And in 1941, which is when the German invasion took place in Lithuania, this man had been, he'd been 17 years old, and he had watched as the Jews of Rokiškis were assembled in a field and marched into the forest to be shot. And those memories had tormented him all his life, and he wanted to speak to a Jew before he died. And the question was, would I be that Jew? So I must say that I was not eager to be that Jew. I wondered whether this man wanted me to forgive him, whether he wanted to name names, whether he wanted to describe horrors that would be very upsetting in a disrespectful way, just what was he up to. But I ended up agreeing to talk with him and meet with me, and that turned out to be, again, a life-changing experience that really changed my, gave me a whole new view of sort of the texture of bystanderism. And I think, you know, we're all bystanders. We all know about horrible things that are happening, and sometimes we stand by. Sometimes we are simply witnesses. This man had been a witness of terrible things, and he had never recovered from that. And he wept and wept as I listened to him talk about, you know, we drove through the town together, and he pointed out places where things had happened. And it was actually a very moving experience in which I sort of went beyond my view of, you know, I was brought up to think the Lithuanians were the worst. The Lithuanians stood by. They were glad that the Jews were killed. And indeed, only about 10% of the large Jewish population of Lithuania survived the war. And there were people who went out of their way to kill Jews to collaborate with the Nazis. There were also people who went out of their way to save Jews, and the vast majority of people did neither. So what was going on with them? Were they indifferent? Were they hostile? Did they feel helpless? And meeting with this man helped me to see that it's not just one size fits all in a situation like that.
Right. Now, I was struck in your book, there were a couple of things that I thought were very powerful. Among them was this notion of memory and the ability of a society to bury certain elements of the past. Now, it's complicated in Lithuania because after World War II, it became part of the Soviet Empire, essentially, and the Soviets kind of changed history, as you talked about, in the society. But it seemed that one of the things that you were interested in was how younger people in modern Lithuania didn't even know what had happened, that there was this whole kind of willful forgetting, it seemed. And yet, I think you at one point, I thought it was really profound that you mentioned how in America we have a similar kind of forgetfulness about our past. And I thought, you know, it's actually, yeah, because I'd felt, as you did, that Lithuanians, if they felt that there wasn't a Holocaust, that they were not involved in a Holocaust in Lithuania, it was a sort of denial of the past, an active denial. But it seems much more complex than that. And I thought that you really explored that deftly.
That was a fascinating aspect of my journey to Lithuania. I met people who had grown up during the Soviet era, which lasted from the end of World War II through 1991, when the Soviet Union collapsed and Lithuania became an independent nation again. I met people who said that it was impossible to find out anything about the Holocaust during that time. I met other people who had grown up at the exact same time who said it was impossible not to know. Everyone knew. They had always known. And so in the book, I compare that to the situation here in the United States, where I sort of imagine, suppose a Lithuanian journalist came over to the United States and started interviewing people about racism. And I think that that person might find some Americans asked about, you know, the Jim Crow laws of the South before the Civil Rights Movement, that people would say, oh, that's just something of the past. There is no segregation now. There are other people who wouldn't even know what you were talking about when you used the phrase Jim Crow. And then there would be some people who would say, yes, you know, racism pervades our society. So I think that's true in Lithuania as well. I do want to mention the very complex situation they have there of what has been called competing martyrologies. So we know that the Jewish population of Lithuania was targeted by the Nazis and by the German invasion. And again, over 90% of the Jewish population did not survive the war. And that is unquestionably a genocide, an annihilation of a people. But many people in Lithuania also feel that Lithuanians were targeted in a genocidal way by the Soviet Union. So just before the Germans came in 1941, and then again after the war, the Soviet authorities sent tens of thousands of Lithuanians to Siberia, and many of them died, and whole families were deported, often, you know, without trial, and often without much evidence at all. Just the Soviet Union was in a great hurry to kind of stabilize the society. And this was a very, very disruptive and painful aspect of Lithuanian history. So during the time when it was time to sort of process the Holocaust was also the time when many Lithuanians felt oppressed by a foreign power, the Soviet power. And the Soviet Union, for many years, did not want to talk about the Jewish tragedy. Many of the plaques at the killing fields in Lithuania, in the forests, were at first, right after the war, plaques were put up that said, you know, here died 1,500 Jews. Those plaques were taken down or covered over by Soviet plaques that said, here lie 1,500 innocent Soviet citizens who were killed by fascists. So it was a kind of reconfiguring or mutating of the history in order to pursue Soviet ideals of perhaps internationalism. Even some people think that in a way it worked out well because it said that the people who had been killed by the Nazis were of us. We were all together in this, and the people who died were our Lithuanian family. But on the other hand, it concealed a very important truth, which was the history of this anti-Semitic, anti-Jewish genocide. So all this kind of swirls together in Lithuania today, this mix of hatreds and resentments and feelings about the past and senses of stolen destiny and of genocide. It is very, very complex. But what I found there was some evidence of some hopeful things going on. And I found there are activists there, there are educators there who are passionate about bringing Lithuania into a confrontation honestly with its past. So you have Holocaust educators who are writing curricula for Lithuanians of all ages. You have people writing discussion questions for high school students, serious ethical, rigorous questions about the Holocaust. I was especially impressed with an organization called the House of Memory. And they have a project that brings school children into contact with their elders in their villages and towns. And the school children come in and say to their elders, what do you remember of the Jewish past? And these older people may have watched what happened, they may have participated in a good way or a bad way, and may never have talked about it. Especially during the Soviet years, there were people who felt that it was not a good idea to talk about the Jewish past and what their role had been in that past. So here you've got school children talking with their parents, their grandparents, even their great-grandparents, drawing maps of the old Jewish community, because most towns in Lithuania were half Jewish and half non-Jewish before the war. And people, the school children are mapping this and saying, you know, here this bakery used to be a Jewish school, this warehouse used to be a synagogue. And it's a very, very sobering experience for them to see this lost world, this vanished world. And people begin to ask questions and to discuss among themselves, in a spirit of respect, what has been lost by Lithuania. That was just one of a number of very sincere projects that I visited and where I talked with the leaders of them, that gave me some sense of hope that a country can move forward from the terrible scar of genocide. And that has implications not just for Lithuania, but for other countries around the world that are facing that kind of situation.
So do you feel that, you know, just aside from your personal, the change that occurred, you know, that happened to you by being there and by witnessing so much of the actual history. Another scene that struck me was when you went to the ghetto, I think it was in Shavel, if I'm remembering this right, where you walked around. There's some pictures in the book where you show one of the boundaries of the ghetto, and you described how small it was and how many people were there. And when you walked into it, I think there was this feeling that I can really understand, of almost trepidation and this fear that you will feel too strongly what must have happened there, that the ghosts and memories, even if they're not physically present, if you're aware of what happened there, they become very powerful.
It was extraordinary to step into the site of the ghetto, past the gate where my Uncle Will had been stationed, and to go in there and, first of all, to just try to imagine 5,000 people crammed into this tiny area with little muddy roads and alleys and little outbuildings and sheds, dogs barking, and there was almost nobody there. There were, when I was there, lace curtains in the windows. One person passed me on the street and would not say hello back when I said hello, and it was haunted. It was a haunted place. And the amount of history that saturated that area was just amazing to feel. And to just, I felt that my head was just banging with all these questions and people and my uncle and my cousins. And it was an amazing, amazing feeling.
Do you find that a lot of, do you hear from other people in America, other, you know, Jews of Lithuanian or maybe Latvian, other Baltic, you know, people who have similar experience, or maybe even from other countries? Do you talk to people about what happened to you, and do you find that people here are interested in and kind of able to comprehend the kinds of things that you experienced?
Yes, I think there, especially since the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991, there's been a stream of people from other parts of the world going back to these places where Jewish culture once flourished and was then annihilated. And some people don't want to go back. They say there's nothing there. Other people go back and look very carefully for the traces of Jewish life, and that can be a very moving experience. And I've talked with a lot of people who have had that experience. There's a whole huge cadre of genealogists here in this country who are looking for these little scraps of daily life that connect them with their past and sort of tell them who they are and make them feel connected to this world in a different way. I think what's a little different about what I did was that I kind of forced myself to step out of the Jewish past and to take a very wide look at what is there today, and how today's society in this place where Jewish culture once flourished, how today's society is connecting with that past. So non-Jews have inherited these places where Jews were once very populous. And so what are these people doing with their past? And asking that question and maybe asking how I could help them connect to that past is what led me to write this book.
Well, you know, you do. One thing I thought of while I was reading it is you have this big advantage that your family, you know more about where your family was and what they, where they lived and who they were relating to than a lot of people. That so many, as you mentioned, a lot, there was a big wave of immigration from Lithuania in the 19th century, and in my family, for example, it was a huge amount of effort just to find out what town our family was from. I mean, both my grandmothers and my grandfathers from two different places. You know, people don't know. You know, and especially for a lot of immigrants, I think maybe the Jews have this special thing because of World War II. The feeling was in previous generations that they weren't looking back to that past, and they certainly weren't going to want to, you know firsthand what happened in Lithuania or in Poland or in Hungary because it was too painful. But they also had no information. And so
That's right.
I think, you had this great advantage of your great uncle being alive. That's a phenomenal thing. And mm-hmm. and having that firsthand contact with the homeland, as you call it. One thing, and we should mention also that there is this thing of, I've recognized it. Lithuanian Jews are called Litvaks. And when they see each other, they say Landsman. There's a kind of recognition that that's a special community. But for people who are listening who may not know, Lithuania is this relatively small country. I think 3.5 million people, you said?
That's right.
And prior to World War II, there was a very large Jewish population. I think overall it was 750,000, 800,000 people, which is a pretty large population.
It was 240,000 Jews, but you're right. It was a large part, especially in the cities of Lithuania. It was about a third of the population, and also Jewish culture in Lithuania, especially in the capital city, what is now the capital city of Vilnius, or Vilna as it was known in Yiddish, had a sort of an outsized impact. It was a cultural center without parallel. It was known as the Jerusalem of the North. So there, what was lost there was something very, very significant.
Yeah, no, I agree. And, well, now let's talk a little bit before we lose track of time. I want to talk to you about Yiddish because, that's what got you started in this in the first place. And I'm kind of interested in you struggled, and you talk about this a lot in this class, how hard it was to learn Yiddish. How complex the language is, and that was an ongoing theme, I think, for you. Then finally you had the kind of breakthrough where I thought you were able to, it became easier and it became smoother. But this took a long time. How long did you study Yiddish, not just in Vilnius, but prior to that? How long have you been studying Yiddish now?
I've been studying for about 20 years, and again, it was as a memorial to my mother that I decided to do this, and it's been just a wonderful, wonderful journey for me, a way to connect to my people, a way to feel Jewish, and I've always loved languages, and studying in Vilnius was such a privilege. It was just a complete, as I say in the book, a machaya, which means a great joy. And it was also very difficult, and we just busted our heads every day on these texts. But but what was so rewarding was that this was a way to kind of almost meditate, to go deep inside, to focus in a way that the scholars of Vilna always did as they pored over the Talmud. Here I was poring over these texts in the Hebrew alphabet, which is what Yiddish is written in, and feeling that I was continuing a cultural, a heritage, a literary heritage. And it was a way to kind of recover in some ways from the terrible, painful things I was hearing about Lithuania's past and also seeing in Lithuania's present. You know, I ran into anti-Semitism and concepts that were difficult for me to get hold of, and moral questions that perplexed me. And so to be able to just sink into these sentences and go through my dictionary and figure out what this meant and savor these syllables on my tongue, it was really a wonderful way to, it was almost like, I think, a kind of prayer for me.
I think that's a really beautiful way of putting it. So, and you continue to study Yiddish, I take it, now?
Yes, I do.
And do you write in Yiddish at all?
No, I'm part of a weekly Yiddish reading circle, or a monthly, sorry, which is called a Lehenkreis, which means a reading circle, where we spend an evening a month just speaking Yiddish and reading from, we pick out a story or some kind of text and read that, and that's wonderful. And then also, with a colleague of mine, I've been working to translate the work of an American woman who escaped from Hitler's Europe right before the war and wrote in Yiddish for about 60 years. Her name is Bluma Lempel. And my friend Aaron Taub and I have completed a manuscript of her fiction, which is just wonderful, surreal, and very illuminating about Jewish life in the 20th century. And we've just won a prize from the National Yiddish Book Center, the 2012 Translation Prize, the first prize they've ever awarded for that manuscript. So I feel that my connection to Yiddish is deep, and it's of long standing, and long may it wave.
Well, and it's probably worth saying, I think you mentioned in the book that there were 30,000 books written in Yiddish, which I didn't realize the number was so large, in this sort of golden age of Yiddish, probably 1900 to 1940.
Probably about 150 years, yeah, through the 19th century and through half of the 20th century, yeah.
And are there any books still published? I mean, are there books being written in Yiddish and published today, I would assume, in Israel and in any place else?
The main usage of Yiddish as an actual everyday living language is in the ultra-Orthodox communities, Brooklyn, Israel, and a few other places in the world. And these are places that are, again, deeply religious, and it's not really a continuation of the secular
Yiddish.
Right,
the literary tradition is not flourishing. It's sort of...
And so there's a little bit of Yiddish literature still being written, but mostly I think what we have is it's an artifact. The Yiddish literary tradition is something that we can appreciate and study and translate, rather than expecting it to kind of revive on its own.
And you did read in the class, and you mentioned some of the names of the great Yiddish writers.
Shalom Aleichem, Yudalama Peretz, Mendele Moicher Sforim, and so on, yes.
Yeah, and so do you still read? I mean, obviously you do read in Yiddish, but who would be your favorite Yiddish author?
Well, again, Bluma Lempel, I've really deeply explored her work over the last several years. I love Shalom Aleichem. I think a lot of people have been introduced to his work through Fiddler on the Roof, which is an adaptation of his work. There's so many, Avraham Reisen, Manny Leib, Moishe Kolbach, Avraham Sutzkevel, many, many writers. It's a rich literary tradition that is a way of learning about our past and how our forebears lived.
So one sort of technical Yiddish question, because I'm not really expert in any way, but I remember I have Hungarian Yiddish and Lithuanian Yiddish in my family, and I remember them saying that they spoke it differently, that, you know, my grandparents on one side spoke a different Yiddish than the grandparents on the other side. And I'm just curious, was the dialect in Yiddish pretty broadly different as you went to different places in Europe?
Well, I spent my time in Lithuania itself, where the Litvak dialect was spoken. And I think it's probably about the same, maybe a little more pronounced than what we have in the United States, where the Deep South would be one dialect, Maine would be a different dialect. British, you know, the British accent is something else. So you find people in Lithuania saying kugel for a, like a pudding. In Poland or Hungary, they might say kigel. In Lithuania, they might say for the word fish, which is the same in Yiddish, they might say fis with an S instead of a sh, whereas in the more southern parts of Europe, they would say fish. So all that is the subject of a great deal of hilarity and poking fun and so on in Yiddish culture.
And but grammar pretty much established, not variant as much as pronunciation.
Not as much, right.
Okay. Well, I loved your book. It was really, I don't think it's just because I'm Lithuanian and just because I'm interested in the history of Judaism and the history of Jews in Lithuania, but I'm sure that had played a role. But I would certainly recommend the book to anyone who's interested in, I think, ideas about how people of different cultures and backgrounds can overcome their differences and learn how to interact and relate together. I think that really is something for everyone, whether you're Jewish or not. What's going on in Lithuania is really interesting in terms of trying to restore and one of your, I don't have the exact quote, I should have written it down, but that they're trying to build a civil society.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was really, really powerful. This idea that it can be done, it does require an immense amount of work and sensitivity, and you can't force it to happen.
That's a really good way of putting it. Yeah, that was, I went to Lithuania on a kind of a roots trip, a Jewish roots trip, and I was expecting to just sort of leave it at that. And then I was very surprised to find myself kind of pulled into this larger exploration of how people do get along, how you recover, how you move forward from a terrible, terrible past. And I feel that the question that I came out with was, how do we remember? And can we honor our heritage or our diverse heritages without perpetuating the fears and hatreds of the past? And I ask my readers to engage with that question and meditate on it.
Well, I think you succeeded, at least in my case. You did make me think about it, so I want to thank you for that. And
okay, well, thank you, David. It's really been a pleasure talking with you.
You as well. This has been Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I've had the great pleasure of talking to Ellen Cassidy about her book, We Are Here, Memories of the Lithuanian Holocaust. Thank you so much.
Thank you.